From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we're on the trail of fugitives and lost pets. First, we talk with New York bounty hunter Tom Evangelista, whose family bail bond business was the subject of an HBO reality series. Then we hear from former canine cop Kat Albrecht. She now trains and uses dogs to search for lost cats, dogs, and other pets. She'll tell us how lost pets behave and how search dogs can track them. Albrecht's book is The Lost Pet Chronicles. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new Sidney Pollack film, The Interpreter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Like a lot of Americans, Tom Evangelista runs a family business. But his isn't a corner store or an internet company. Evangelista operates a bail bond business in Queens, New York, employing his wife, son, nephew, and cousin in running an office and, when they have to, tracking down fugitives who skip bail. Evangelista's family is as colorful as his job. His brassy blonde wife, Flo, will say just about anything, and his oversized nephew, Chris, has a way of adding a little drama to every day. We got to know them last year when they were the subject of a 10-part documentary series on HBO called Family Bonds. Explain to us, if you will, what a bail bondsman does. I mean, how does he make or lose money?
I'm an insurance agent. That's pretty much what I am. I write through an insurance company. And when people don't have enough money to pay a cash bail, if a bail was $100,000 and they don't have that type of money, they would come to me and they would put up probably a piece of property or a very large percentage of that in cash. And then we would take the risk and charge them a premium, just like your homeowners, your auto, or your health insurance. There's a mandated premium that's set by the state of New York. And then that's how I make a living from the commissions off of that bond.
And then while your defendant is out on bail awaiting trial, they're supposed to check in with you regularly. You're supposed to know where they are, right?
Well, the best way to put it is that I can't guarantee his presence unless I monitor his activities. We monitor their activities based on our guarantee or our affidavits that say that we promise to either bring them to court or to pay. So the only way I can guarantee that is if I know what his activities are, if I at least monitor his activities. And the activities being making sure he doesn't leave the state, he doesn't flee or make an attempt to flee, or someone has his bags packed. And the other hand, too, I mean, we don't bail people out to continue to commit crimes. We may very well do an inspection and find, a house full of drugs. If we do, he goes back and he loses whatever he has there in regards to drugs, depending on what jurisdiction we're in. We'll call NYPD, and they'll come in and they'll take over that case. But, we bail people out so they could face the judge like a gentleman or a lady with their attorney and fight their case.
Now, if they disappear, you come get them, right?
Well, if they disappear, then that's when I go from wearing a suit to wearing some street clothes. And, yes, I will pursue them, look for them, apprehend them, and bring them back and bring them back to the judge.
When you're at work, when you're out apprehending someone, I would imagine that you probably want to give that defendant the immediate impression that it makes no sense for them to resist you or to flee. Now, the audience can't see you. Describe, if you will, what you look like and what you wear when you're out recovering a fugitive.
Well, I mean, my normal stuff that I would wear when I go out to apprehend a fugitive would be probably a regular pair of street jeans, probably my sneakers or my boots. But we carry some self-defense stuff in regards to OC spray, Aspartame, and always carries, handcuffs. And shirts that identify who we are, and IDs, ID cards and badges who identify who we are. I'm not, as far as my personal appearance, I mean, I'm not a wrestler. I'm an average guy.
Well, you're muscular, and you bring a number of guys with you. So there's a pretty overpowering presence, I guess. I mean, not that you bully people, but right.
Well, that's the whole idea of it. I mean, I'm not going to go pick up one guy with two guys. I'm going to go there and pick him up with four guys because, the way that I look at it is this. The guy doesn't show up for court, that's a no-no. And now my job is to turn around and bring him back so the indemnitor, whoever signed for him, does not have to pay. And in turn, I don't have to pay. But the most important thing is this. I treat everybody the same. If they want to be treated like gentlemen, they know that the somewhat jig is up. They're going back. They can either go back like gentlemen, and that's exactly the way I'll treat them, or they're going to go back and we'll make a stop for some medical attention, and then they'll go back. But they're going back. I mean, that's it, plain and simple. Thank God. I mean, I'm doing this for over 10 years, and I've never had to even give anybody a Band-Aid. So, and I don't want to either. We don't want confrontation. I make it so I use my brain more than we do muscle, if that's probably the best term.
Right. And you also use your voice. I mean, now, the way you said that to me, we can go back with a stop for some medical attention, or we can just go back. Mm-hmm. That communicated to me that you are not a guy I want to take it outside with. I mean, I'm wondering, did you develop a certain way of shaping your voice and your presence when you talk to defendants, or did that come naturally?
It came after I was stabbed once or twice and got the smacked out of me, excuse me, a couple of times. And then I realized that, this is not getting anywhere being Mr. Nice Guy. And it's not that I'm not a nice guy, but when you push me on that side of the wire, okay, right now I'm in the middle. I'm between the courts and the defendant. And as long as we stay on that fine line, then we have no problems. I have no reason to come and see you. But if you push me onto that side, then it's almost like you would see, a metamorphosis change. I mean, I go from Mr. Nice Guy standing in the courtroom with a shirt and a tie to Tom's going to go get his money, because now it's a dollar sign. And I have to look at it that way. It's nothing personal. It's just business.
Have you been stabbed? Tell us about that.
I had a defendant that didn't show up for court. Well, actually, he did show up for court. I take that back. He was beating his wife up, and then he disappeared for about 4 or 5 days. We started to look for him. His next court date, I think he had about 2 or 3 days. But when he showed back up, he was a Hispanic gentleman, probably in his mid-40s, drunk out of his mind, shows up and threatened that he was going to shoot everybody in the house, and he had a loaded gun in his pants, tucked in his pants. But when I got there, he was listening to Spanish music and with a bottle of rum in his hand, and he was dancing around in circles. But every time the guy got his back to me, I wanted to come in. I'm looking through the window. I want to come into the door and try to get the guy, but I'm afraid he's going to turn around and get the gun and start shooting. So, I mean, I did probably the smartest thing. I just knocked. And when I knocked, he came to the door drunk, and I went, Jose, and he said, hola, and he lifted his hands up, and I took the gun out, and I pushed him in. And as I was putting cuffs on him, one of the people I was with wasn't watching my back, and his daughter, that's about 12 or 13 years old, stuck me in the ass with a metal nail file.
Wow.
So that was one of my battle scars. I got stuck in the right cheek, and I had to be taken to the hospital because it was so close to a major artery that was in the cheek of my butt that I covered it up with duct tape, but then the ambulance guy took me there with this thing sticking out of my butt.
So you didn't want to pull the nail file out yourself?
No, well, I couldn't. They told me not to do it when we called for the ambulance. They said, and then when the guy looked at it, he said, you're lucky you didn't, because we don't know how close this to the artery. I'd actually take an x-ray. But lo and behold, when I go in there, I find, this was in East Meadow in the hospital in Nassau County, and I have like 3 or 4 people that I know that I went to high school with that are in there, and they're all nurses. And, of course, I have this file sticking out of my butt. It wasn't one of my most memorable moments.
Well, it was probably one of their most memorable moments.
It certainly was. I still hear about that.
Well, Tom Evangelista, I'd like to play our audience a clip from the show. And this is one of the crew that works with you on the apprehensions, Dan Bosworth. And he's describing, he's talking to your teenage son, Sal. He was a teenager when this was taped, working at a pizza shop. And he's describing a recovery that they'd gone through the night before. Let's listen.
What's up, bro? What's going on, man?
What time did you come home last night?
Like 3 in the morning. You missed an awesome recovery.
What happened?
Holy shit. We got to the house. Lenny answers the door with a knife. And Chris is like, can you put that knife away? He says, we really need to come in and discuss something. We're here for so-and-so. So we go in, we search the whole house. Chris goes near the crib, pulls the laundry bag out, and there's the guy under the friggin' crib. The girlfriend goes.
He was hiding under a baby.
He's under the baby's crib a little. And then all of a sudden, she starts flipping out, trying to jump on your father's back and claw him, and she's got claw marks on his neck. So I run up, I grab her around the waist, and I just held her up in the air by her waist. You missed a great one last night.
Once I turn 18, I'm never going to miss one, bro. I'll be there every day.
You got to come out.
I can't even come and stay in the van. I have to turn 18 before I can come out, legally.
Now, Tom Evangelista, what we hear in that clip is Dan Bosworth is really juiced. He's excited by this kind of violent apprehension that occurred the night before. And your son, Sal, is even more excited. He can't wait to be a part of it. Now, they clearly get off on the intensity of finding a fugitive and bringing him back home. Do you?
Well, I could tell you that in the beginning of this business, when I was waiting for my bondsman's license, I was that's what I did. I did fugitive recovery. Back then, it took about a year to get a license, and that's how I made a living. I'm going to say that, you know, in the beginning, it of course, your adrenaline pumps up, and you're all excited, and you're looking for this guy for 3 weeks, and all of a sudden, bing, you come across him. There he is. Yeah, it's exciting. It's like anything else. You know, you accomplish something that crazy. Yeah, you get your adrenaline pumped up, excited. As far as my son goes, my son is a very unique kid. I mean, I couldn't ask for better kids. He's more excited about the apprehension of fugitives than he is about running or learning the bond business at that point in that stage of the film. Now he understands that, you know, that's not how you make a living. I mean, we make a living by bonding people out of jail. The other part is actually, it's not cost effective. Sometimes it might take me 2 or 3 months on and off of looking for somebody, versus, you know, the guy goes to court and I don't have to waste all that time. That's more time that I have to go and help other people get out of jail. So it's not cost effective in essence for the business or in the bail bond business. Does he get excited? Yeah. Does he still get excited? Yeah. After he recovers, you know, 1,500, 1,800, 2,000 fugitives, it's going to be second hat to him like anything else.
You're coming to work on a Tuesday, and you know that for the next couple of days, you have no apprehensions. You're going to be working the phones. You're going to be doing your business. Do you look forward to that Tuesday more, or the Tuesday coming in when you know that night you're going to go out and get a dangerous suspect?
I look more forward to that Tuesday that I know that I'm going to be in my office doing my bails, making my money, and leaving at a reasonable hour to go home with my wife and my kids. Yeah. I would prefer that any day of the week. Matter of fact, I would prefer never to have to chase a bad guy again.
We learn in this series that you're a two-pack-a-day smoker, at least at the beginning of the series. Is this job stressful? I mean, I your wife seems pretty relaxed about it, but, you know, you're going into some tough neighborhoods looking for some bad actors. Does this eat at you?
Well, I mean, like anything else, I mean, I don't take anything too serious until the time comes. I kind of get my mindset before I leave that, you know, what I'm looking for and who I'm looking for and what type of a person I'm looking for. Does that make me smoke? Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a stressful job. The bottom line is that, yeah, I smoke. And two packs, sometimes I get into my moods where I smoke one pack, sometimes more or less. Is it the job? I think it's a combination of my nutty family and the job. And as you can see, we're kind of unique. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And if we weren't, I don't think that Stick Figure would have approached us to do the show.
Right.
But, yeah, it's stressful. And I think it's more stressful knowing that some nut can be behind the door with a shotgun and waste me. And I'm not going to let my son or my nephew or my friend go walk in first. It's my guy, my obligation. I'm going in first. But I'll take those steps, and I'll take it as it comes, you know?
Tom Evangelista runs a family bail bond business in New York. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Evangelista runs a family bail bond business in New York. I spoke to him last fall when he and his crew were the subject of an HBO documentary series called Family Bonds. Well, Tom Evangelista, you were approached by this production company to tape you and your family, not just while you're apprehending fugitives, but while you live your lives. Did you know your family was so entertaining?
I could say this. When we first started, when we first saw the first few episodes, it was like watching a home movie. So I'm going to have to say, yeah, I didn't think that they were entertaining, per se. I do know that some crazy stuff does go on in my house and my business with my family. Did I think that it would be an HBO series? No. I mean, a documentary? Yeah. But one of the big things that I, in the beginning when Stick Figure approached me, was I was not interested in doing the standard bounty hunter show.
Well, this show isn't just, you know, this show isn't just about bounty hunting. It's about this wacky family that you got.
It's about my family. That's the reason why I did it. In the beginning, I said, no, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do a standard bounty hunter show.
Well, let me ask you this. Does it get it right? Does that look like the family that you know when you see these episodes?
What you see is what you get. That's us. I mean, we don't do anything different than we do if the cameras are there or not. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we do that these guys aren't there and they miss, and they get very upset because they miss it, but it happens.
Like what?
We had one night where Dan decided that he was going to try to he was going to try to wax Chris's hairy back, and he used a piece of duct tape. I mean, is that normal? No. Well, these guys, unfortunately, they weren't there to film it, but Chris let him do it, you know? I mean, I went and I bought I have a Rottweiler, and I'm trying to train him, and I bought one of these electrical, you know, those collars, you know, those electric collars. And when you give him commands, you know, if he doesn't listen, it rings, it makes a tone, and then after that, it has an electric pulse that jolts him to let him know that you're trying to, you know, get his attention. And you could heighten that either up or down. Well, my son and my nephew decided that they thought it would be a good idea to try to see, you know, what this feels like and who could take the most juice. And they have me pushing the button, which was fine with me because I wasn't doing it, you know. But they're holding this thing like on their arm and they're saying, okay, I could do number three and pushing the button and then I'm electrocuting them. And I'm saying to myself, I said, go call your mother. She's not going to believe that you two knuckleheads are letting me electrocute you at the table. So, you know, this stuff does happen every day. I wouldn't use the word wacky. I would kind of say more unique than most.
Right.
Or nuts, and nuts maybe.
In episode two, we see your son Sal's 18th birthday party.
Yes.
Which gets a little out of control. Now, one of the characters is your nephew, Chris, who works with you, has on the bail bond business, and he is a big guy. What is it, 290 maybe? Bald head. I mean, he's an imposing fella. He has too many and gets into something with another friend at this party. You know, a lot of people.
I'd like to thank you by saying he's 290. I think he appreciates that.
Oh, really? I'm selling him short. That party, you know, it gets pretty wild. I mean, we see you know, a lot of cake icing in people's faces, and then kind of a nasty confrontation. Mm-hmm. Do you or are the rest of the family embarrassed at all by that?
No, and I'll tell you the reason why. The circumstances that surround any party that involve my nephew, always somewhere the end result is being drunk and starting an argument. I mean, that's just standard operating procedure at one of the evangelista parties. And, you know, I'm kind of prepared for it, and I think everybody else is too. Am I embarrassed by it? No. Why should I be embarrassed by it? It's not that I went there and pulled my pants down. This is what happened. And if I pulled my pants down, I wouldn't be embarrassed either. But that's besides the point. No, I'm not embarrassed. I mean, this is my family. I'm never embarrassed about my family. One thing I could say is that regardless of what anybody sees on TV and regardless of what anybody thinks, these people are my family, and they would give their lives for each other. And that's kind of the concept, if you think about it. Every time that we go out, one is watching the other. One is willing to step up and risk their life for another. That's what family's all about. So we do play hard, but we work hard too.
The other thing that's striking about at least a piece of your family is your wife flows conversations with her friends at the nail salon, which is pretty sexually explicit about you and her. And I mean, Howard Stern has nothing on this show. How do you feel about that stuff getting out there?
Well, let me tell you this. I'm going to say this, and I've discussed this issue a couple of times. I don't think that, if you notice in that one episode, she's discussing and talking with her sisters.
Right.
I mean, you know, they're sitting in the nail salon, and they're getting their hair done and doing whatever, and they're talking about sex and about this and about that. I mean, if you think about it, what do we talk about when we're sitting around a bar having a couple of drinks?
Well, I don't think we do it with the camera running. That's the difference.
But the difference is that it just doesn't really matter. That's us. And
yeah.
She was discussing what she was discussing when she was discussing it. And if the camera was there, then the camera was there.
Well, what she discusses in part is you being one of the most sexually potent men on planet Earth. I mean, how do you feel about all
about
of us
that.
Knowing that?
I don't remember hearing that part.
Oh, you got to rewind the tape, potent. Tom. You got to rewind the tape and listen to that part again.
I didn't hear that part about being potent. But Like I said, I work hard and I play hard too, you know. When I'm home, I like to enjoy myself. And if it may be jumping on my bike and going for, you know, a week away with my wife or going away for a week with my wife and enjoying ourselves, that's what we do. If she discusses it with a friend, with her girlfriends or her sisters and her friends and, you know, whatever she discusses, that's part of reality, I guess. That's what makes us, I guess, different than some of these other reality shows. Are we sometimes we go, oh my God, we shouldn't have said that? Yes. Are we embarrassed by it? No.
Well, Tom Evangelista, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Tom Evangelista, whose family bail bond business was the subject of an HBO documentary series last fall. They're still in the business, and Tom and Flo are renewing their marriage vows next week. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel, Night and Day, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. And from Delta, publisher of Gossa Gossa Girl, a novel of suspense and the Japanese-American experience by Naomi Hirahara, author of The Summer of the Big Bocce. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
When former canine cop Kat Albrecht lost her bloodhound AJ, she put a golden retriever on the trail, found her dog, and embarked on a new career, pet detective. Coming up, a talk with Albrecht about finding lost pets. Her book, The Lost Pet Chronicles, is now out in paperback. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film, The Interpreter, starring Sean Penn and Nicole Kidman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Kat Albrecht is a real-life pet detective. She estimates she's helped over 1,800 pet owners locate their lost dogs, cats, snakes, turtles, ferrets, iguanas, and horses. Earlier in her career, she worked as a police officer and detective. She handled bloodhounds on search and rescue missions, and her first missing pet case involved her own bloodhound, AJ, who dug out of his kennel. Albrecht contacted a friend who owned a golden retriever. The retriever found AJ in 20 minutes. Terry Gross spoke to Kat Albrecht last May, when Albrecht had just published her memoir called The Lost Pet Chronicles. It's now out in paperback. Albrecht told Terry that most search dogs are actually useless for finding pets because they're trained to ignore the scent of other animals.
most search and rescue dog handlers spend much of their time discouraging or disciplining their dogs if they get off on animal scent. That's because it's critical that when you're working a law enforcement case that your dog is focused on finding the human scent and that it is trained to ignore dogs, cats, and other critter scent. So it's definitely not something that you can call up the average search and rescue dog handler and ask them to come and track your pets. So I knew this when I ventured into this territory, and I knew that once that I made the transition with my police dogs that I could not go back and use them on law enforcement cases again. So it was a tough decision.
Was it hard to retrain them to search for animals?
You know, no, it was actually quite easy because they had always, particularly Rachel, had loved kitties. And in fact, I would be directing her to search for a gun or evidence, and she would lope off on a bunny hunt, and I'd be yelling at her to go find the gun or to search for the physical evidence. And so we always had these little tiffs about what I wanted her to find and what she wanted to find. So the first day that I presented a tuft of fur under her nose and told her, take scent, find the kitty, she just looked up at me like, yes, finally you understand what I've wanted to hunt all along. So I found it quite simple. And also with the bloodhounds, my two bloodhounds too, once I scented them, they just would take off and just love to track the animal scent.
Now, you know, I always assume that a lot of animals don't really like other animals. A lot of cats are loners and they don't care for other cats or dogs. A lot of dogs don't get along with other dogs or other cats. So do you need a particularly gregarious search dog to do this kind of work?
Yes, actually, I now have several dogs in training, and I'm launching seminars on how to train your dog to find lost pets. And what I look for in the dogs that I train to find cats are dogs that love kitties. So we put them through a testing process, an evaluation, and they have to show the behavior that they want to be with a cat. They're not going to chase and harm a cat because this is search and rescue, not search and destroy. And the dogs that we train to track the scent trail of lost dogs are the dog park dog mentality, the dogs that want nothing more than to play with another dog. And if they don't exhibit either of those behaviors, then they just don't pass evaluation, and I don't spend the time training them.
Is it easier for a search dog to trace the scent of an animal than a person? What I'm thinking is that, like dogs particularly, your average dog is probably a little smellier than your average person, although your average person can be pretty stinky if, on certain occasions. But, you know, just kind of like generalizing, are dogs smellier and easier to find?
You know, that's a good question, but I don't know. And I don't, I've just noticed that the dogs have been able to be successful at both. And so I haven't been able to tell. And obviously they're not talking. But what I do know is that it really depends on the motivation of the dog. And if you have a dog that loves people, like my search dogs have, and they love to eat cheese, and they know that the person hiding at the end of that scent trail is going to give them a piece of cheese and going to pet them, they will do anything they can to follow that scent trail to find them. That's the basis of the training. With the dogs that we train to find missing dogs, their reward at the end of the trail, after they sniff the bedding from the dog or that we have hidden out there, their reward is that they get to play with that other dog. So they have such a high play drive that when they get there, they're rewarded and they just work. They use their noses and they just get there.
Yeah. What if the dog on the other end doesn't really want to play? What if that dog wants to attack?
Well, during training, what we do is the only dogs that we hide out there, that we lay a trail, as we call it, they're laying a scent trail as they're walking along, and we call those target dogs. They are dogs that love to play with other dogs, so they are always rewarded with that play at the end. On actual searches, oftentimes we never make it right up to the dog. In a typical lost dog case, we establish the direction of travel, and that enables the owner to be able to place the lost dog posters and interview witnesses in the neighborhood and get a positive sighting and recovery of their dog.
You have two bloodhounds now. What makes bloodhounds so good at following scents?
Well, bloodhounds were bred to hunt animals centuries ago, but they, in particular, they were used to hunt people And they're known as manhunters. They just have an instinctive drive to use their nose to work a colder, what's called colder, older scent, meaning they can track a scent trail after it's been out there several days. Their bodies are built for hunting. They have jowls that causes them to slobber, and that moisture will collect the scent. Their long, dangly ears will ruffle scent particles that may be dormant on the ground and enable them to, to enter the nasal cavity and they can process it. They're just hunting machines. Other dogs can be and are trained to do what bloodhounds can do, but what sets them apart, in particular in law enforcement cases, is that their testimony is acceptable in a court of law. When it comes to criminal prosecutions, what a bloodhound does on a case, if it meets certain requirements that the courts have set up, is acceptable testimony.
I'm sure you've witnessed a fair number of pet reunions between people and their lost pets. You know, a dog will kind of run to see you and jump all over you if, you know, when the dog is happy to see you, but cats show their affection in a less obvious way sometimes. You know, I mean, the cat will come to the door and fuss to be petted, but they're not going to... They're just different from dogs. Well, what are some of the cat-person reunions been like? Do the cats rush over to meet the people after they've been found?
No, actually, most of the cats have been hiding in fear. Mm-hmm. And therefore, their owners, one of the primary tools that they've used to recover their cat has been a baited humane trap, which is a tool that's used right now by feral cat groups to recover unwanted wild cats. And it's one that we advocate using as a recovery tool for a missing cat. And many of those owners are holding a panicked cat that's scratching and trying to get away from them, because a cat is so traumatized by the experience of having escaped outside. But those reunions, I'm looking at and what I really see is the joy in the owner and just the, you know, thank you so much. I can't believe I have my cat back. Primarily what we hear is, I can't believe he was this close all along. I called him for 3 days. He never meowed, and he was right here all along.
Right where, usually?
Usually the cats that we are finding that are displaced, meaning they're indoor-only cats that push out a window or escape out a door, are either hiding under the owner's own home, under their deck, or in a neighbor on either side of them. They exhibit what we call the silence factor, meaning they do not meow, and they will stay there. Some of the cats, depending on the temperament, if it's a skittish, shy cat that has neophobias, meaning it was from kittenhood experiences and genetics, it is just ingrained that this cat will hide under the bed even when a stranger comes in the house. Those cats can remain outside for 6 to 8 weeks without making a sound, and the owner, if they do not understand that the cat is nearby, they will give up searching, and that cat will be absorbed into the feral cat population.
So do you think the cats usually recognize their people when they are reunited?
I think that the cats recognize their owners, but their instincts take over in a way that you don't see with dogs. Dogs, of course, there's the happy licking, excited whining, I'm so happy to be home. Whereas with the cats, their instincts are to protect themselves from predators, and they even see their owners as being a potential predator. That's why they hide and they don't meow, and they can be 3 feet from the owner's front door for 3 days, and the owner thinks, you know, that their cat ran away from home. Cats, they're just a different animal than dogs. And, you know, I'm learning that myself with the cats that I have now. I try to treat them like dogs and try to hug and kiss them, and they do not appreciate it as much as I would like them to.
You've described a little bit some of the cat patterns when a cat slips out the window or door and runs away from home. What about dogs? Are there any typical patterns of dogs who are lost?
With dogs, it's different because dogs travel. Cats are territorial. Their instinct when they are sick or injured or afraid is they will hide and they will not meow. the first thing they do is look for some place to hide, and they make that their new territory. With dogs, they will move if they are frightened, such as by fireworks. They will move at a rapid speed, and they will run blindly, and they're at risk of being hit by cars. But they oftentimes will run until they get to a point where they can hide somewhere, like in a garage or behind somebody's wood pile in a yard. But the distance that a dog will travel or will be found from their escape point varies, and it depends on several factors, and some of those have to do with human behavior. You can have a skittish, shy, mixed breed dog, a pit bull mix, trotting down the road, and people will not pull over to try to rescue that dog. But if you have a Irish setter or Old English sheepdog or purebred French bulldog that's trotting down the road, people will be more likely to pull over because they will think lost dog or valuable pet or something of value that they want to keep themselves. And so they're more likely to intervene if it's a purebred, highly recognizable dog. So that's just one example of the human behavior. And if you have a dog that is skittish and shy and will growl at somebody when they try to approach it, that dog is going to travel farther than will a wiggly butt golden retriever that, you know, will run up to the first person that that talks to it.
Pet Detective Kat Albrecht speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's hear more of Terry's interview with Kat Albrecht, who works as a pet detective. Her book, The Lost Pet Chronicles, is now out in paperback.
You train dogs, but you've also had to work with cats because you have at least one cat that you've used as the target cat. In other words, you train the cat to just kind of act as if it's lost so that then you can teach the dog how to find the lost cat. Are cats hard to train even to do something simple like staying still and acting lost?
Oh, cats are great. And, you know, before I started training my dogs to find missing cats, I had always pretty much owned a cat, but I was not hooked in as a cat lover until my first experience with getting a great cat, and that was with Myron. And when I got Myron and started training him, I had to harness train him to walk on a harness and leash so he could lay a scent trail. And I write about this in the book, how I had gone into the veterinarian and took Myron in there and told the vet tech how I was harness training Myron. Well, she thought that by harness, you know, that the bloodhounds wear harness. And she looked at Myron and looked at me and looked back at Myron and said, "You mean you're training your cat to track lost dogs?" And so it was pretty amusing. But the other cats that we use now, including this obnoxious orange cat named Cheeto, are kitties that love dogs. Myron and Cheeto... just they're so accustomed to my dogs, and every morning when I let Cody out, she'll find and lick them and play with them and get all excited about, you know, washing the kitty's face, and the cat's just kind of like, yeah, whatever. But these cats have a gregarious temperament. They're ones that crate well. I've trained them by placing them in a crate and setting them outside and putting bread and bird seed down. They could sit. They learn to lay quietly in these crates because their reward is they get to lay and watch birdies come and eat, and so they don't become fussy or upset while being in the crate. So when we go to the trainings, we take these cats in the crate and we will hide them in some heavy brush, and we have the cat detection dogs. We take them one at a time and have them search around. And when they find the kitty, they are trained that they will give the physical alert. Typically, they're wiggling and wagging their tails. They will run back to the handler, jump on the handler, go back to the kitty, and then we open the crate up, and the kitty is let out, and they're on a harness and lead, and then the dog gets to play with the kitty. And the cats are so used to it, they love it. They'll, they look forward to the training dates. They run into the crate when they see me pull it out.
You used to work with dogs for the police, and you used your search dogs to help find lost people, clues, dead people. In your experience, did the police have a lot of faith in search dogs? The police that you worked with, yeah.
It depended on the agency and on the individual investigator that you know that had called me out. You know, initially, the one of the first police departments I worked for had no faith in bloodhounds. In fact, after spending 18 months there, they basically said that bloodhounds will never be used here. If you want to work your dog, you need to go elsewhere. And so I did. And I landed with a department that was supportive and in an area of California that had previously used bloodhounds with great success and other search and rescue dogs. So I found it much easier when I went over, when I left Fresno County and went over to Santa Cruz County. It was much easier for the agencies to call me out with my dogs. One of the first searches that I used my cadaver dog on was the Poly Class search. And that case then opened the door a couple months later for Rachel to work a homicide case where the detective really was skeptical. He really had never seen a cadaver dog work before. And in his experience with the police patrol dogs that he had seen, he had not had much faith in dogs. But when Rachel went out there and was finding the evidence that was right out there, but it just wasn't visible, he was impressed.
What advice would you have for people who have lost a cat or a dog? Do those posters on the trees or in the convenience stores help?
Well, the posters help primarily with lost dogs because typically the dog is out there, it's traveling, and somebody's going to pick it up. Invariably, a lost dog is going to end up with somebody who finds it, and they either self-rescue it or they turn it into a rescue group, or they turn it over to a friend. Sometimes they take it to the animal shelter, but don't count on it. You still want to search the shelter every day, if possible, for your dog or cat when it's missing. But really, your focus with a lost dog is getting the word out there that your dog is missing, and really focusing on getting the word out to a lot of rescue groups, because oftentimes many of the missing pets end up, or missing dogs end up there, and are never taken to the shelter. The one place where the dog owner is searching is often the last place that anyone will take it because of the fear that it will be put to sleep. With missing cats, cats will be close. Some cats are transported out of the area, but if it's a displaced, fearful cat, it's going to be nearby and hiding, and using a baited humane trap as a recovery tool is a primary way to get the cat back. We have a website that I would recommend that if you've lost a pet that you check. It's www.lostapet.org.
What do you do with your search dogs when they're ready to retire? How do they take to retirement?
Well, AJ is retired, and, you know, they just still live
there. Do they play golf?
No. No, he just lays. He just sleeps a lot and watches a lot of TV. You know, they just they're just not working anymore, and they get used to seeing me take off with the other dogs. So, you know, it's hard. AJ is 12 now, which is really old for a bloodhound. Mm-hmm. He's deaf. He's gray. His body has really changed a lot, and you know, I'm not sure how much longer he'll be around. But you know, he was a wonderful search dog, and you know, he's a hero, and you know, so he deserves to rest and play golf and watch TV the rest of his life.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your work and your animals.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Kat Albrecht speaking with Terry Gross last May. AJ, the beloved bloodhound Albrecht spoke about at the end of the interview, was laid to rest on July 7th of last year. After hip dysplasia caused his back end to fail, he was put to sleep wearing his bright orange police vest. His final meal was the food he loved the most, broccoli. His ashes were spread in Santa Cruz, along the trail where he made his one and only felon find. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new Sidney Pollack film, The Interpreter. This is Fresh Air.
¶¶
Nicole Kidman and Sean Penn star in The Interpreter, a new political thriller with a mission set at the UN and directed by Sidney Pollack. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The Interpreter is a thriller too bloated with its own significance to deliver the requisite thrills. It's directed by Sidney Pollack, who made one of the scariest paranoid thrillers of the post-Watergate era, 3 Days of the Condor, and whose legendary clashes with Dustin Hoffman helped produce the fluke comic masterpiece Tootsie. But Pollack's Oscar for Out of Africa convinced him he was a major artist, and his subsequent movies have been weighted down by humorlessness and self-importance. Speaking of humorlessness and self-importance, The Interpreter gives us Sean Penn, with gray hair at the temples, as a Secret Service agent trying to foil a mysterious and possibly bogus assassination plot against an African dictator who plans to give a speech to the United Nations General Assembly. Penn can't play just any agent trying to do his job. He has to have his own traumatic backstory, an overflowing well of grief over a dead wife, because what's a Penn performance these days without the actor emoting in close-up for a camera frozen in awe? My theory, and it's just a theory, is that a multi-million-dollar rewrite guy, either Steven Zaillian or Scott Frank, who both get a screenplay credit with Charles Randolph, got hired to load emotional baggage onto Penn's part. Otherwise, the focus would be entirely on Nicole Kidman as a UN African language interpreter named Sylvia Bloom. Sylvia leaves a tote bag in her translation booth and hears a whispered plot through her speaker, a plot to assassinate Zwani, the president of the fictional African country of Matoba. He was once an idealistic liberator, but now he's an ethnic cleanser. She reports what she heard to the authorities, but Penn's agent Keller thinks she's hiding something. After all, she has lived in Matoba herself, which partially explains her peculiar accent, and she has many reasons to despise Zwani. This scene has some crackerjack dialogue, even if the hostility between the two characters seems a little trumped up.
How'd you happen to be up there after hours?
We had an evacuation. I left some of my things in the sound booth. I had to go back for them.
Mm-hmm. And at that moment, there happened to be a couple of fellows talking about an assassination in a language that you and maybe 8 other people understand in a room full of microphones.
Do you think I'm making it up? Why would I report a threat I didn't hear?
People do.
I don't.
Some people like attention.
I don't.
Maybe you don't want Zwani at the UN.
I didn't make it up.
How do you feel about him?
I don't care for him.
Wouldn't mind if he were dead.
I wouldn't mind if he were gone.
Same thing.
No, it isn't. If I interpreted gone as dead, I'd be out of a job. If dead and gone were the same thing, there'd be no UN.
Your profession is playing with words, Miss Broom.
I don't play with words.
You're doing it right now.
No, you are. If I wanted him dead, I wouldn't have reported it. I would sit back and let it happen. It's not what I want. That's not why I'm here.
As the knotted-up Sylvia, Nicole Kidman is excellent, although she's sometimes upstaged by the locks of hair that hang artfully in her face. It must have been very hard for Pollack to answer the old, "What's my motivation?" query, because Sylvia seems to have about 10 conflicting motivations in the course of the movie. A former Matoban rebel, she's now the film's spokesman for a non-violent ethos she translates from a language called the Ku. She and Penn's Keller fix their blue eyes on each other and have a lot of dark night of the soul exchanges that take the wind out of an already convoluted conspiracy plot. A light touch would help, but with the exception of a well-designed set piece involving several agents and suspects converging on the same bus, The Interpreter is stodgy and misshapen. It manages to be both thoroughly confusing and entirely predictable, thanks to a plot twist you see limping towards you about an hour before the maudlin hero manages to. The climax comes with a civics lesson, in which the heroine spells out that ethnic cleansing is a very bad thing indeed. It's admirable when A-list Academy Award-winning talents attempt to make something more meaningful than a mere cloak-and-dagger thriller. A thriller with a message of peace and nonviolence and a commitment to international human rights. A thriller that banners a non-Western philosophy that's radically different from the usual eye-for-an-eye politics of American action movies. but I can't help wishing for a certain ruthlessness and low cunning in the area of pacing. The interpreter is so lofty, it feels as if it were made to be screened at the UN.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Dave Davies. Terry Gross returns on Monday.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from PBS, presenting Deep Jungle on Nature. Jungle exploration begins Sunday night at 8, 7 Central. Local air times may vary. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Undercover ATF agent Billy Queen infiltrated one of the most dangerous motorcycle gangs in America. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Queen about what he had to do to prove himself and how he almost lost himself in the process. His new book is Under and Alone. Also, actor Anthony LaPaglia. He played Daphne's drunken brother on Frasier. He has a new film. Join us for the next Fresh Air.